On this week's 51%, we speak with the director of Safe Inc. of Schenectady about the many risks faced by homeless youth and what they're doing to help combat human trafficking.
I think awareness is an important thing, and I think that people have to have a good understanding of what it is and what it looks like.
We also learn about New York's new paid prenatal leave law, and our Dr. Sharon Ufberg chats with singer-songwriter Morley about her album Follow the Sound. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh leader. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. It's getting bitterly cold here in New York. Exposure to the elements is a major threat for unhoused people, but it's one of many, especially for those under the age of 18. Tracking how many young people are homeless in the U.S. is difficult. Estimates put the number as high as 4.2 million minors and young adults, with unaccompanied youth accounting for 22% of all unhoused individuals under the age of 25. Our main guest today is the director of a Capital Region shelter and nonprofit dedicated to at-risk youth. For 40 years, Safe Inc. of Schenectady has provided counseling, case management, life skills training, and short-term housing to teens and young adults. Kevin Doherty says the nonprofit's McIntosh House is open 24/7, 365 days a year for youth age 16 to 20 who have either run away from home, found themselves homeless, or been sexually exploited. Safe Inc. also provides case management to young survivors of sex or labor trafficking. He says neither homelessness nor sex trafficking appears in real life the way it often does on TV. I recently spoke with Doherty to learn more about their work. Just a heads up that our conversation touches on domestic violence, child abuse, and sexual assault. If you or someone you love has been impacted, please know you're not alone and help is available. There are organizations like Safe Inc. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is available at 1-800-799-SAFE. The National Human Trafficking Hotline is 1-888-373-7888. And the New York Office of Children and Family Services has a number to report child abuse at 1-800-342-3720.
There's a huge nexus between, you know, domestic violence and youth homelessness. You know, many of our youth are either victims of domestic violence or witnesses of domestic violence. And so that family discord is really what pushes kids oftentimes into homelessness, because they're looking for something and they don't feel safe at home. So our outreach program tries to help them identify some resources so that they can feel safer, so that they can stay at home or find other housing if needed. We also operate a shelter. It's a 12-bed shelter. We serve 16 to 20-year-old youth, males and females. And while they're here, we try to find them housing, more long-term housing. Oftentimes, they end up being reunified with their family. But if they need an apartment or other housing, we help them to do that. And while they're here, they receive case management, counseling, job training. And then 60 to 90 days after they go to wherever their housing is, we continue to provide follow-up services for them. Our other program is a human trafficking program. We serve a 7-county area where we provide case management, mental health counseling, assessments, referrals for victims of trafficking. And those are individuals who have been identified and confirmed by the state and the Department of Criminal Justice Services as being victims of trafficking. And we help them to get into a safe place, stay in a safe place, and do what they need to do in order to be able to live a life outside of being trafficked. 95% of the folks in that program are women or younger than 18, minor females, but 95% are females.
Of course, you know, being homeless is dangerous for anyone, but for kids and young people especially, you know, what risks do you see them facing on the street?
Yeah. They're at risk for a lot of adverse outcomes. You know, they're at risk for being trafficked. It's really hard to identify how many kids are trafficked as a result of being homeless. Some estimates are it's 20%. But it depends upon what your definition of trafficking is. If your definition is commercial, then yeah, maybe it's 20%. But if it's somebody, needing a place to stay, wanting a pack of cigarettes, and they're exchanging sex for those types of things, the number could be, significantly higher, but it's difficult to get youth to admit to doing that. Do you know what I mean? For example, we ask four questions on our intake here, trying to get to that with them. And more often than not, they all say no, never. Working with them, we have a feeling that that's not true. But, as a result of their own shame or embarrassment, they're not willing to fully disclose it. But they're also at greater risk for gang activity. They're at greater risk for criminal justice involvement. They're at re greater risk of teenage pregnancy. They're at greater risk for, committing domestic violence themselves because they've learned it. And now they're usually in situations where, violence is a solution. And we try to address that. But if they're homeless, it's more prone. They're more prone to do that. So there's a lot of really bad things that can happen to youth who are homeless.
You mentioned that there are different definitions out there for homelessness and human trafficking. So how do you define those terms? Especially trafficking, because I think because it's such an upsetting subject, when we talk about it, we tend to talk about it in a very vague way, and that makes it hard to identify, what it actually looks like and what the warning signs are.
I like to think about it from the same definition that schools tend to think about it, which is if a youth is housing insecure for one night, meaning they're not with their family, or they're with an adult, or their family is with another adult, or the family has to stay somewhere else because they can't afford their rent for that particular night, or they ran away because of family violence. It's that one night away from home that really qualifies a youth, particularly, as being homeless, because it points to that they're vulnerable, when they're in a situation like that. And in terms of trafficking, people think about what they see in movies and that people get kidnapped and put in cars and driven across borders and then, introduced into a life of prostitution, basically. And it's really a lot more subtle than that. More often than not, victims of human trafficking are being trafficked by people who are close to them, whether it's family members or a boyfriend or a significant other who's benefiting monetarily or emotionally from that controlling relationship. So a lot of times, particularly we find females are in situations where they may not have the money, or they may not have the job skills, or they may not have an apartment, and they have to survive. And so they utilize their bodies to be compensated so that they have a place to stay. And then it becomes an emotional connection between the two people.
And trafficking is not always a sexual thing, right? There are other types of trafficking.
Yeah, there's labor trafficking as well. And that's where people are, forced to do work that they're not adequately compensated for. They may be given a place to stay or to live with somebody, but they're really working for free and they're working for where they're living. And again, it's not a fair exchange. And I think that that's a key part of it. But again, sex trafficking is a lot more than prostitution. So we'll have, if we have a 15-year-old kid, a 16-year-old kid who comes to stay here, who has been staying with friends, quote unquote, for a couple of weeks, and engaging in, in sexual activities with them for a place to stay, that's trafficking.
Well, the month of January is National Human Trafficking Prevention Month. So I wanted to ask, what does that prevention look like? What can we do to address this? Are there signs that we should be looking out for? You mentioned that, it's hard to even get the youth that you work with to talk about it. What does that work of establishing trust and giving survivors a safe space to tell you what's going on look like?
Well, for us, it's difficult because they don't stay in a shelter for very long. The average time that a youth is here is about 2 weeks. But we find when they develop a relationship with a counselor or a case manager, and we provide some aftercare supportive services, that's when they're more inclined to address those kinds of issues. I mean, that's true of anybody who's had any kind of traumatic experience. They have to develop a level of trust with their professional clinician or case manager before they are willing to, disclose things. I think awareness is an important thing, and I think that people have to have a good understanding of what it is and what it looks like, and that it's not what you see in the movies, but it's people you know. It may be somebody at your job. It may be somebody, a neighbor. But if you suspect that it's, commercialized trafficking, certainly call the police. If you think that it's something between an adult and a child, call Child Protective. And if it's just somebody you know who has experienced it in the past, who needs help dealing with it, then refer them to mental health counseling or Safe Inc. of Schenectady. It depends upon the nature of it. But if there's a youth involved, I always suggest calling Child Protective and calling the police.
Well, you guys provide emergency shelter for people aged 16 to 20, but you're working on a project to provide more long-term housing and care. So tell me about the new campaign Safe Inc. is working on.
Yeah, so like I said before, the youth aren't here for very long. But we recognize that when they get to be about 18, 19, 20, they really want to change in their lifestyle, and there aren't a lot of alternatives out there for them. They haven't gotten their high school diploma. They haven't been working. They don't know how to budget money. There's a lot of things that they don't know how. And so, if somebody comes from, and I'll use myself as an example, if I come from a pretty middle class family, when I graduated high school, my transition was college, right? So they don't have a similar transition. So what we like to do is we like to take our knowledge of them, our knowledge of their experiences, our knowledge of their needs, and provide them more long-term housing. We don't think that it necessarily needs to be permanent supportive housing because they're in that age range where it's sort of inherently transitional living, right? So we want to be able to build apartments, one bedroom apartments, start out with 12 of them, and provide them with supportive services. We'll have a case manager go in a couple days a week, mental health counselor, other professional staff. I mean, it's their apartment, but we're helping them. And we're helping them to get their education or helping them to get their GED. Sometimes they don't have their papers. Even if they were born, at Ellis Hospital, they don't have their birth certificate. They don't have their school records. They don't have their social security card. They don't have the basics. So they can't get a job. They can't get an apartment. They can't apply for higher education. So we want to be able to take that year and a half, 2 years to help solidify them. And like I said, it's expensive to do that. Whether we find a place to rehab or we find a site to build upon, it's about $250,000 to $400,000 per person. So if we build 12 beds, you do the math, 250 is $3 million. And so we have a committee here, about 8 to 10 people, and we're developing a case for support, which is what we need to go public in order to share our goal and our mission, our dream, and how important this is and why our solution is needed, because it's not really a solution we have in Schenectady.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for taking the time. I just wanted to ask, New York's next legislative session just started. Is there anything that the government or the community can do to make the work of organizations like Safe Inc. easier?
I think having more mental health resources, and I think having more school-based prevention services would really go a long way to do it, because the school is where you see the kids, and the school is where you get to know the kids, and the school is where you can identify the problems. I mean, teachers are great at identifying the kids who have, who have issues at home, who need other resources, and there aren't enough resources out there. It's gotten more difficult since COVID because we're all the not-for-profits who do mental health are having a hard time finding staff because of the money involved, the salaries. They can get paid more to work remotely than they get paid to do face-to-face. And it's really difficult. And we per you know like Safe Inc. of Schenectady has a difficult time competing with Ellis Hospital, with St. Peter's and Albany Med in terms of social workers and therapists, because they can pay 50% more than I can. And that makes it difficult too. So if government could help school do more school-based prevention stuff, it would really go a long way. And then community organizations like myself could work in collaboration with the schools, and we could really do a comprehensive set of services for each youth or child.
Kevin Doherty is a director of Safe Inc. of Schenectady, which provides outreach, case management, counseling, and shelter to homeless and at-risk youth in New York's Schenectady County. You can learn more about their work at safeincofschenectady.org. Again, if you or someone you love has experienced domestic violence or sexual assault, know that help is available. We'll have links to resources on our website, wamcpodcasts.org. Kevin, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
New York State recently became the first state in the country to mandate paid prenatal leave for pregnant workers. Being pregnant is not the same as being sick, but a lot of expectant mothers end up having to use sick time in order to make it to their prenatal appointments. Or worse, they don't go at all. And these check-ins can be important to monitor how mother and baby are doing. New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced the paid leave measure as a way to promote maternal health and hopefully reduce maternal and infant deaths in the state. I recently spoke with Labor Commissioner Roberta Reardon to learn more about how it works.
This is for all pregnant workers in private sector employment, whether they're full-time or part-time, and they are allowed up to 20 hours a year for prenatal healthcare visits. And that year starts when the first time you take the benefit. So it's not January through December. It's if you take it in April, it's April through to the next April. And it is for that pregnant worker to go for tests, for monitoring, for exams, discussions with your healthcare provider about to make sure that you're going to have a healthy birth, fertility treatment, very important, and of course, end of pregnancy care. So very comprehensive. It is for the pregnant worker alone. It's not for the partner. And it is really exciting because for a long time, pregnant workers, particularly women who worked hourly jobs at lower wages, were really stuck having to make that decision. You look at the bills on the kitchen table and you go, ooh, this week, I really need my full paycheck. I'm going to move that exam off a couple of weeks. That's not a good idea. Everybody knows that all the statistics say that a little preventive care, particularly with pregnancy, really pays off in the short term and the long term. The outcomes are always better. So we don't want any pregnant worker to have to make that decision. Don't ever have to decide, do I get my paycheck or do I go for a checkup? And for the governor, it's personal. She's a mother. She knows what this has been like. And she's very focused on making sure. She always says, New York State is a wonderful place to live and work and raise a family. We just have to make sure it's also affordable. And this is part of making it affordable. You're going to be able to make your hourly wage and visit your doctor at the same time.
So how do you access these hours? Do you have to like tell your employer that you're pregnant and that it's for a prenatal visit?
Yes, and it's pretty easy. Most prenatal visits are scheduled well in advance. Very rarely you go at the last minute. But even if you have an emergency visit, you can use this benefit. But you should let your employer know as soon as you know what your schedule is so that they can make whatever arrangements they need to make. But you go off to your appointment and you get paid your regular wage while you're at your prenatal appointment.
And what should business owners know now that this law is in effect?
So first of all, the New York State Department of Labor is here to help. If they have any questions or concerns, they can certainly contact us. Easiest thing to do is go on the website and, you know, alert us that way. We have a lot of people from the DOL who go out to businesses every day, whether it's from workforce development side or from worker protection side, and they bring this information with them. That we're doing a big social media campaign. And actually, it's why I'm talking to you, because you're an important part of our campaign, being able to alert your listeners that this benefit is available. And if they have any questions, they should talk to us and we'll walk them through it, because more than anything else, we want to make sure that businesses are able to fulfill their responsibilities.
So what if you exceed the 20 hours? You know, do expectant parents have other options that they should be keeping in mind?
Well, you do have paid family leave, and there's also FMLA. That's a federal program. There's paid sick if you want to use that, although, you know, I bridle a little bit when people say use your paid sick time for pregnancy, because being pregnant is not really being sick. But if you go through all of your paid prenatal visits and you still need more time, that time is available.
Roberta Reardon is the Labor Commissioner of New York State, which now requires employers to provide 20 hours of paid prenatal leave for expectant mothers. Commissioner Reardon, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Our last guest uses music not just as a creative outlet, but to facilitate dialogues with survivors of human trafficking and war. Morley is a singer-songwriter from New York City whose music weaves together jazz, soul, folk music, and her own experiences as a humanitarian and environmental activist. Our Dr. Sharon Ufberg spoke with Morley about how her work as an activist informs her work. Morley's latest release, called Follow the Sound, opens with the title track, A Spirited Call to Trust One's Own Intuition.
Mama, you said if I ever got lost in a crowd, follow your voice and I will be found. I don't know what happened.
I'm very curious, what was your inspiration for your latest album, Follow the Sound?
Oh, the inspiration is the heart of the matter right now for me, which is the heart of what's happening with humanity, what's happening with our relationship with Mother Earth, and all the possibility and beauty arising around me. The title track is called Follow the Sound, the album Follow the Sound, and that particular song came to me during my time at the U.S.-Mexican border. I was engaged in a protest against the inhumane policies of family separation. And while I was there, I had this dream of a child speaking to his mother after he'd been separated from her. And in the dream, she says to him, if you get lost, listen for the sound of my voice and follow the sound. And so that whole dream became a song. I woke up and wrote it and actually sang it at the border, right in front of the ICE headquarters. And that song is talking about, you know, the very global reality of children refugee, crisis of children refugees. And a lot of these refugees are climate refugees. So the song talks about that, but it also talks about listening to our inner voice and the voice of the natural world as one.
That's really beautiful. Can you describe and speak a little bit to our listeners about how you use your music as a tool for healing? I know that's been a big part of your work.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, I always love to share the quote with whoever I'm working with in whatever capacity, a quote by James Baldwin. I heard him say this in passing in a conversation that I found on YouTube. And he said, when we can describe an emotion, it no longer has power over us. And so when I'm working with people who are in trauma, surviving human trafficking or survivors of war or domestic violence, there is so many emotions that we all have. And if we can't describe what we're feeling, we wind up using our body as a canvas to describe, to express ourselves. And we can get ourselves into situations that are not healthy, that are dangerous. We can, you know, fall into addiction. It's like when things are not expressed. So the power of art to emote and to move the sort of the waters of the emotional body and the physical body so that thoughts and feelings will get lodged in the system. It's very powerful. And then music itself carries vibration, you know, vibrational healing. Music itself is it changes the sort of molecular structure of every room. When there's music, there's sound. And then when there's harmony, forget it. And rhythm, I mean, you know, the human voice carries so much power, but when there's harmony and then rhythm, it can really change our reality in our nervous system, and it can change lives. So I lean into the work, into the music for my own healing. And I love to share it when I do these kinds of workshops.
So what has contributed to your devotion to human rights and social justice causes?
I guess I'd say devotion comes from, I think, having an example. My parents were both civil rights activists. And that was like the teachings I got from my family. And even though there was so much beauty in the beginning of my life, the family did break apart and there was a lot of illness. And so I actually, experienced being displaced as a teenager after my family broke up, and I had to figure it out. And I was very fortunate to get into the High School of the Performing Arts in DC called Duke Ellington. And I realized that I would, write my emotions, write what I was feeling, like on the sides of my sneakers or the back of a paper bag from my sandwich I got from the deli or whatever. I just was constantly writing myself back into life. I realized that I was actually doing art therapy for myself. And fast forward many years later, those kinds of that practice of writing became songs. I never thought I'd be singing. And in terms of the connection to the divine feminine, I just feel like the divine feminine teaches that we are really none other than each other, that like we are the water, we are an extension of the earth. We are not on Mother Earth, we are of the earth. So that gives you a different life when you're not sort of this living only as an individual, but you're actually part of something bigger, and it's less lonely, and it makes me, I mean, it just makes me want to think about the beauty of the opportunity to be in collaboration with each other as opposed to just looking out for number one.
It's hard to stop wanting things to be different than the way they are.
What's next for you? What's on Morley's agenda?
My agenda. Yeah, my agenda is to, as an artist, continue writing and touring. And I'm, touring. I actually have a couple shows in different cities in January. But also, like, I really think about what's next for me is this to continue trying to activate my creativity, my listening, and my imagination.
That was singer-songwriter Morley speaking with our Dr. Sharon Ufberg about her new album, Follow the Sound. You can learn more about her work and upcoming shows at morleymusic.org.
Have flown from this place, never to return in the same way. Wanting them back here right now, to be here with me, to walk into the next phase.
Thanks for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcasts.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. At night and down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house I could have been like. Where are you taking me?